This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight.
All right, welcome back to the main course, OG, Original Gangster. I'm one of your hosts, Patrick Martins. I am in studio with our point guards, Elizabeth Greeley and Emily Pearson.
Good morning.
Morning.
We got Tony Butler, radio personality T-Bone Butler, and me, Patrick Martins. And our special guest for the panel and the weekly grill is Zine Flynn, executive chef of Park Avenue Summer.
Still summer.
Part of the Quality Branded Restaurant Group. You just listened to Rocket 88, which we learned about at Sun Studios in Memphis, Tennessee. That was written by Jackie Brenston, and it was the very first rock and roll song, just like the main course was the very first thing to air. Actually, Emily made me and her husband Dennis made me listen to the first episode to ever air on HRN, and it was actually really good. I was surprised. I was so focused.
You were super focused, but the format was 3 hours.
I just lost my train of thought with that introduction, and yet for that other one, I kept 3 hours of focus. I think only 1 hour still lives. The other two are lost, but anyway, it's a very exciting show. As usual, we have a really fast array of stories that we're going to cover, so I'll throw it to Libby to tell us what's going on.
All right. Well, good morning. It has been a steamy week here in New York City as we lead up to Labor Day. Do you think anyone's listening or everyone's in Labor Day mode already?
Well,
you
know, everyone's in labor.
Everyone's in labor. Oh, God. Actually, I'm reading Handmaid's Tale, so don't talk about that. That's
Everybody's on break. We're the one of the only shows on the network of the 35 shows that's still airing. But because we're current events, you know, we have a duty.
We have a responsibility to
the people.
Yep. So we have some great topics ahead from Lord of the Bees to a $3 million ham to Salmonella. We cover a lot here. So let's get started. Breaking news from USA Today. The grand champion ham of the 2018 Kentucky State Fair broke records last week, selling for $2.8 million. The money goes to charity. And this one is especially exciting for us because the ham was produced by our good friends Ronnie and Beth Drennan of Broadbent Hams. We know you're probably wondering, what does one do with nearly a $3 million ham? Well, you eat it, of course. The winners intend to eat it on Christmas morning for a meal of country ham, biscuits, gravy, fried potatoes, and fried apples. That is a heavy meal they're going to have.
Discuss.
Sounds like breakfast.
Let's discuss.
Yeah. $3 million.
All right. Well, you want me to start? I like that. The number one most talked about thing in Kentucky, you know, because the state fair is like the center of Kentucky. It's like Kentucky's communicating to the U.S. and to the world. That's their state fair. And the ham, a piece of food, is actually what is their highest priced item. It's what USA Today covers about that fair. So it's kind of cool that they, you know, the ham is like an image of Kentucky or used to represent the people of Kentucky. And it's a pork item. It's an agricultural item. You know, we in cities forget about that, but I thought that's pretty cool.
I feel like I missed out. I don't know. New York, like, we have a state fair, but it's not something that, I don't know, growing up in the city or downstate, we didn't travel for it. But this is the thing that people look forward to every summer.
I've been to a couple. I mean, my wife's from Indiana, and the Indiana State Fair is huge, you know, with giant pigs and pigs. But I grew up upstate, and the state fair was a big, I don't know if it is as much, but it was a big deal. I mean, New York State Fair is the oldest state fair in the country. And so, I mean, and maybe it's just that here in this city, we forget that the state is fairly agricultural. You drive out through the southern tier, and it's farms and farms and farms.
Yeah, we have Apple Fest. I went out to Apple Fest, and that was nice.
Yeah.
We have, I went to the Wisconsin State Fair a couple months ago, or a month ago, and it has hundreds, I would almost say thousands of animals. Each animal is owned by a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and they raise it on their farm and they bring it and they stand there next to the animal to explain it. These are chickens, ducks, geese, pigs, cows, horses, and it's just barn after barn after barn. And you spend 4 or 5 hours just amazed and looking and being like, wow, there's 80 kinds of chickens here. You know,
it is, it is
very touching.
And it's kind of amazing because it's individual. These are teenagers, and the 4-H will have the best pies and all this kind of stuff. It's not just these large farms who can grow a, you know, 2,000-pound pig or something like that, which is... but real kids are learning the craft and how to farm it like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of educational seminars and games the kids can play, and they can hold little ducks and this and that. And then the rest of the other 70% of the state fair is fried food stands.
Which is important.
Yeah, I grew up in Washington State, and I always went to county fairs. We never had a state. Nice. Yeah, exactly. We never had state fairs that were anywhere near us, but we had a county fair that was really close, and we always did that.
And what would you do? You would just get there in the morning and spend the day?
Walk through the barns. My allergies would go crazy. And the big thing at my county fair was these space burgers, and it was like a ground meat and then special sauce and lettuce, and it was put in like the old sandwich presses and turned into little saucers. So
they what was in the special sauce?
It was a secret.
It's a secret. He's never found out. Although, have you ever tried to recreate it as a chef at a fancy New York restaurant?
Yeah, well, we do have a special sauce that's very similar.
So, yeah. Wow, inspired by Washington.
Very, very cool. It was one thing I know about the Wisconsin State Fair, it was white. They're very little diversity. And unfortunately, at some of those fairs, it would have been nice if it would have been a little bit more diverse. But other than that, it's very, very touching place to go to. You feel good about America.
I was going to go back to the ham. How do you judge it without eating it? Like, I think they said it weighed, I don't know, 17.8 pounds or something. But is it just, is it on, like, its leg? And it, does it look sexy? I don't know. How do you... Why is that one win? Or George said it went for the most because it has the most cachet. It's from Broadbent or
well,
something.
Numerous hams compete, and then that ham won, and all the money goes to charity. So in a weird way, it's like, again, the piece of food like is the symbol of how much money exists in that state and how much they're concerned about giving back to a community. What was the charity? Do you know?
I don't know. I know that it was split between two winners went in together so that they could, you know, raise the most money. It was a bank and an individual. And I think it was the chairman of the bank is the one that's going to host the Christmas dinner and is inviting the other guy over. But he said he wanted to take it home with him because he wanted to be sure that it was going to be preserved until Christmas.
Sometimes we cover protocols here. If you're invited as a guest to the $3 million ham breakfast, say it's good. Say it's delicious.
Why? I think the rest of the menu is very telling of biscuits, gravy, fried potatoes, fried apples. Whoa.
It should have been a prosciutto-style ham, which could have been shaved over a long time and eaten alone and melon. You know, cover it with gravy. Alone. But by the way, the Broadbents have been around for 105 years, you know, that business, and they make heritage breed stuff. But, you know, I would have liked it better if it was a prosciutto-style ham, but I'm sure it's still delicious.
They didn't mention if it was one of their heritage long-age hams or one of their traditional country hams.
Well, congratulations to Ronnie and Beth. We're big fans of them, and they support heritage food, so...
All right, I'm moving on to the next subject. A person in New York has died, and 17 people from 4 states were sickened from a salmonella outbreak linked to kosher chicken from the largest kosher poultry producer in the United States, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This outbreak is a reminder that germs in raw chicken can spread around food preparation areas and can make you sick. Said a spokeswoman for the CDC. We advise that people always cook raw chicken to an internal temperature of 165 degrees Fahrenheit to avoid food poisoning. And I did read that they're not saying that you shouldn't buy from this particular producer, which I think was Empire Poultry. There was no warning like that. It was just making people aware.
Well, first of all, anybody who says anything negative about Empire is being anti-Semitic of you three, because you guys are, Emily and I can say whatever we want. Because we're Jewish. No, just kidding. What do you guys think?
I'm just constantly trying to not food poison myself when cooking. It's low bar.
Yeah. Right. I always assume chicken has salmonella. I mean, I got it once stupidly when I was about 7 years old and helped my mother cook. We were cooking and we had a bag of open cookies on the counter. So I grabbed, you know, eating them. Lesson learned.
How does salmonella develop?
I guess it just grows on the chicken.
Yeah, it just comes lives on the chicken. Yeah. And hit the right like temperature and time, and it just flourishes. And
yeah.
Do you have you ever had anyone have salmonella at any other restaurants? Because it's about keeping things clean,
yeah,
right?
And I think
and cooking it, and I mean, it'll die. I mean, that's why I assume it's there. So when I'm preparing chicken, I do the chicken first, and nothing else.
Right. And then I think people at home don't necessarily think of all the things that they're touching.
Right.
You know,
right.
Touch the sink to turn the sink on, and then they'll go to wash something else or touch their face. And
do you have different guidelines in your kitchen for like prep for, I don't know, do your butchers prep your chickens differently than they prep your pork or your beef? Like, are there more strict protocols?
Yeah, we have different cutting boards. We also don't, for service, we don't have any raw chicken on the line. We steam our chickens as a roulade first, so that helps us a lot of cross-contamination stuff with that.
Well, you know, I'm always looking for some cause, something to get angry about. So, you know, listen, it's a kosher plant. So anyone who has, like, kosher or wears a uniform or something like that, so, you know, priests, you know, Hasidic Jews, policemen, doctors, nurses, Johnny Cash, you know, the man in black.
Wait, what?
You know, all of these people who wear
you ever hear
some...
the one about the priest, the rabbi, and the chicken?
Yeah. No, but
they walked into
Cash,
a bar?
You have some moral code. That's why he was the man in black. He had a moral code. So if he ended up being a scumbag for something or doing terrible things, it's like, don't wear the costume. Or Hasidic Jews, you know, who are like tough to work with or something like that. But I'm like, don't you have a moral code?
But what's this got to do with chicken and salmonella?
It's a kosher plant.
But kosher has nothing. Just means there were no bugs on the chicken.
It's a standard to say that we differentiate ourselves from other plants that don't do it. We have a higher moral code. It's cleaner. It's better. It's more humane. It's religious. So keep it clean, dude. I mean, if you're just calling yourself a regular plant, you know.
But the article didn't say, the article was very explicit that it said it wasn't the plant's fault.
All right. Well, I mean, it sounds to me like somebody was a little dirty. And, you know, if you call yourself halal and are a shit show, that bothers me. Just be a shit show, but don't call yourself halal then. Don't try to elevate yourself with terms and labels and then violate them. You know,
I don't know. It's also hot in New York. It could have been transport. Who knows? I don't know. There's a lot of steps along the way.
Chicken just come with chicken. It. You know, it could happen to any plant anywhere. It's not,
all right. I'm sorry.
You got to cook your chicken.
Yeah.
Next.
Although,
all right.
No one added that. Me on that.
It's getting
I was
hot
just in
there,
Japan
geez.
A couple weeks ago, and they ate raw chicken in certain places. Wow. I definitely had undercooked chicken a number of times. Like
people say Japan's one of the only.
How are you feeling?
Good.
Oh, okay. Chicken's
raw, but it's like doused in lemon or something.
No, absolutely.
Oh, really?
No. Yeah. Wow.
People say that, I mean, I know like Catherine, our colleague, has been to Japan a few times, and we've always talked about it. It's one of the only places that Americans also feel comfortable even trying it. It's right. Very much outside of our comfort zone. It's not what we were raised to think as the norm. And I think probably Japan is the only place I would, but I wouldn't know who to trust or who not to trust. Like,
right.
did you go to a specific place knowing it was super clean, or was this like street food?
No, it was like street food. So it was, you know, yakitori street food. And it
was it tasty?
It was really good. It was actually it's like the cartilage from the chicken, okay. And they just kind of fold it over on a skewer and put it on the charcoal, and it's really good.
It's awesome.
Interesting. All right. The Wall Street Journal published a piece this week focusing on a topic that we have discussed more than once on the show, Danny Meyer's hospitality included policy. Back in 2015, Danny Meyer said that tipping is a drug and we need to kick the habit. That year, his restaurant group, Union Square Hospitality, started to phase out tipping. But the Wall Street Journal reports that the trend never really caught on. Though his cooks received raises and overall retention and service metrics have improved, it has not really gone as planned. Restaurants that adopted the program early on have stabilized financially, while later converts are heading there. So what do you think?
About tipping? What do you guys think?
I mean, I think it's... Danny Meyer's, it's a brilliant idea. People should be able to, first of all, plan on how much money they're going to make. I think prices should be more predictable. When I go to a restaurant, I prefer. And I don't think tipping, I mean, the whole idea was, it's an odd thing that if you don't give enough money to your waiter, they're going to do a crappy job. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the mindset. I assume that people are professional. And I've never, I mean, once or twice in my life, I had a really bad service, but... And I know, like, when I'm traveling in Europe, it's interesting that a lot of restaurants, smaller, you know, your neighborhood restaurants, the people waiting on tables are middle-aged. It's a career for certain people. They can make enough money to support their family. It's not, here in the United States, waiting is a transitional job. Till you get most people.
Till they get their acting gig.
It's a lot of that, or they're moving on to something, probably because it's the salary structure. I mean, there's exceptions in upscale restaurants and things like that.
So, Emily, what do you think? I know you're have thought a lot about this topic.
You're about to call me cheap, aren't you? There's something. You're going somewhere with that.
I do think, by the way, all checks should put what the tip should be. I like it. They're like, if you tip 20%, it's this. If you tip 25%, it's this. If you tip 30%, it really helps because I never, you know, if I don't bring my tip calculator, I never know what
to do. So alternatively, I have a friend who's a CDC or an executive chef in Connecticut, and this particular restaurant group puts a service fee. It's a kitchen service fee. I think it's like 3%. And it's indicated on the bottom of the menu that it's something that they do. So it's not hospitality included, but it is your food. You're seeing your food bill. You're seeing your drink bill. You're seeing the 3%. You're seeing your tax. And then you tip on top of it. So I don't know. I kind of like maybe that compromise, that you're still protecting your kitchen. You're building in something that maybe raises their salary from $12 an hour to a really solid $15. You know, I don't know the exact numbers, but and then you are choosing to tip based on service. But I don't know. I flip flop on how I feel about it.
Yeah, that's something that's actually legal in New York.
Is it?
Adding the extra service charge. A couple of restaurants tried it a few years ago, and then they got shut down pretty quick with that.
I think it's an odd thing that it mandates the consumer to have just pricing for the restaurant. The restaurant should have just pricing. I don't want to think about what that person putting the plate down makes, and that it's not my job. The bill should reflect the real cost of doing business and just salaries and food and everything. I mean, obviously it's difficult in this town because the margins are so tight.
Yeah, I think the problem is like sticker shock. If it's just Danny Myers doing it, and then if you don't realize it, you're like, oh, this is a lot more. And then you're not thinking the 20% is already included. Yeah, no, so maybe people are driven away by that.
But it's that American thing that we love things $9.99. We don't want to pay $10 for something.
Mm-hmm. So when you see it at $12, then it's a totally different story.
Yeah.
Well, I think Danny Meyer's doing well with it because his is a successful restaurant group to begin with. And then those other ones who just are very small restaurants, but they're like, we're going to do it too, or might not be, you know, Union Square Hospitality. They're suffering. Like if your restaurant group did it, you know, the quality branded restaurant group, it would be fine. They would still remain successful. But it's, you know, like the challenge for our buddy Jonah at Huertas. He took on a real challenge because his was a single small Spanish restaurant in the East Village.
Yeah, I mean, he was actually, he'd probably yell at me for saying this, but he was sort of born out of the Union Square Hospitality Group. And I think, you know, of the decisions that Danny Meyer has made as an industry leader, I think he liked that particular one. And as a small, independent chef partner or chef owner, it was a choice he made. I think I have trouble with it when it's on, like, a glass of wine. You already know how much alcohol is marked up. And I think when you see it, you know, I guess you're like, oh, well, tips already included. But there are people who, like, don't tip super generously at bars and don't give 20% on a glass of wine. And so when a glass of wine is $19, you know, instead of the $15 or $16, maybe they order a beer. I don't know if that's hurting people even at the bar.
I mean, I was just curious. I mean, how much do people not tip? Because essentially the final nut you pay is the same if you're a decent tipper. Doesn't matter how it's... But or they're not, and you as a restaurant, do you know how many people just don't tip?
Well, Europeans, right?
No, but that's but how many in this country don't? Because it's expected you tip essentially.
Yeah, I think it's pretty across the board. Everyone's tipping fairly well, 15 to 18% on average.
Interesting. All right. Well,
yeah, I think if anyone can do it, it's Danny Meyer though.
Yeah.
You know, he's got such power behind his restaurant group, and those restaurants are, you know, they've all been around for a while. And
any move that works to retain employees is great. It saddens me to hear all these places are like, oh, no one's indispensable. He leaves, she leaves, we'll find someone else to fill it up. I'm like, no, isn't your goal to keep all that corporate knowledge building with people who've been with you for decades, as Tony started off the segment with?
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I think that's been one of his biggest difficulties is retaining front of house staff. I think
Danny Myers?
Yeah, he's lost a lot of front of house staff with.
I think he's retaining more back of house because that's who he's sort of protected through this.
I think they kind of shifted towards the back house.
Yeah, you're protecting the kitchen and then because I don't know how it breaks down, but obviously people are not, you know, going home with an extra couple $100 of cash in their pocket at the end of the night. And that's the thing. It also completely eliminates the cash tip.
Mugging has probably gone down because no one has cash in their pocket anymore. But let me ask you this. If Danny Meyer would have just take Gramercy Tavern or Union Square Cafe or, you know, any of your restaurants, Park Ave, and then says, I'm just going to pay all my sous chefs $20,000 more, all those chefs that, you know, were taken care of by this move. Would all those businesses have gone out of business? I mean, how huge an expenditure would it have been to just pay those people more and leave tipping and everything the same?
And do like small menu increases.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just like, take care, pay them more.
Right.
And the shitty restaurants wouldn't be able to do that and should go out of business. I think there's too many restaurants in New York. And the good restaurants would be like, we're doing fine and we're paying everyone a fair
wage. And have more customers.
It was almost like an excuse not to pay a fair wage. They, you know, said, we're going to do this so that we'll pay a fair wage. And then another group of people is like, hey, what about us?
Right. And I think that's kind of the direction where things are going, you know, especially with the minimum wage going up. So everybody in the back house will be making more money. And I think the increases for the back house employees at the, you know, Union Square Hospitality Group have been like somewhat like inflated, or if they say they got raises, but I think across the board, everybody's been getting raises in the back house.
Mm-hmm. You just made a point, curious, that impacts the front of house, really hurts your tax structure. I mean, some people are making serious cash money, which may or may not have been reported, and now it's changing. I mean, it impacts their salaries, even if they're making good money now, it's all, right. IRS sees it all. And
then from an operator standpoint, we pay, we have to take more sales tax in, and we also have to pay more payroll taxes.
Right.
So wait, this is actually a question I was going to ask you later, but since it's on topic, it's slightly self-serving, I guess.
I was thinking about jumping to that too. That's good.
I'm curious, do price increases at a restaurant, you know, going up by a dollar or two on the menu, do they really affect the customers and how they visit?
And we'll say the reason it's self-serving is because this isn't imminent or nothing's happening like this on a business level, but when we're like, we have to go up 50 cents on the pork chop, they're like, then I have to go up $2 on the menu. And I'm like, will anyone notice a Babbo or a Chispaca or, you know, all these great restaurants we work to? It doesn't mean we can be willy-nilly, but, you know. Does it at Park Avenue? I don't know. Maybe I'm completely wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. I think any, you know, increases will affect things over time. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think back to like college and my accounting classes, and you see this like nice clean line of like supply and demand and how that works. It's not exactly like that for most restaurants. And, you know, it just depends on the situation you're in. But, you know, maybe people see $45 for, a piece of meat or something instead of $43. Maybe they don't get a side. Or maybe they don't get, you know, or they share a starter instead of, you know.
So it's about the immediate sticker shock of looking at the price on the menu. It's not about remembering what you paid last time. It's more just like, that's a big number.
Right, right.
I see.
Are there tipping points? I mean, you can raise it so far because I'm sure it's not an easy, even curve.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a big difference between 50 and 55 versus...
Well, tell us.
Once you start hitting $50 for like a main course and like $20 for appetizers, that starts, you know, just a mental, like looking at that price and seeing like, oh, $23 for, you know, an octopus. Like,
so you have to be under 20 for apps and you have to be under 45 for mains unless it's a thing for two?
Right around there's a good like sweet spot. We're, you know, right around $20 for apps and right around 40 for our main courses.
I think 39 must do better than like 41, right? There is something mental about it.
And there's also a mental something component about the actual numbers that's there. There's like friendly numbers.
I know.
Minds, like twos and eights and fours are very comforting.
Sevens and nines. And I think nines.
Sixes are nice. Nice and
sixes
round.
Sixes are nice, yeah.
Like tummy.
Typically even numbers are more comforting.
But then also, you know, as a menu pricing decision, I've been told that you might build in, like, let's say the price of a piece of meat needs to go up a dollar or two, but you know that that's going to dissuade people from ordering it. Maybe you would raise a pasta dish by that money instead to compensate. So you make absolutely. Up where your food costs might be lower, but raise the price of that dish.
Yeah.
Is that something you do?
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a mix. There's always a couple of items on the menu that have, like, higher food costs, like 35 to 40% for some items. You know, and then the others that are 20 to 22%. So,
what's the most a chicken can go for?
We've been discussing this recently. We're at $32 right now for our chicken dish.
What's that? A whole chicken or no?
That's half. It's a
whole kosher chicken.
A breast, some thigh, and our garnish, our typical seasonal garnish with it. I actually did some menu comps recently for our area, and a lot of places are at 34, 33, so we were considering raising it, but we kept it. We're keeping it at 32 for now.
Interesting. Steak, that is always the highest. I mean, that makes sense for it to be the highest.
So we have filet. on our menu, and right now it's at 46.
Okay, and what about veal?
Veal, I don't serve any veal. Yeah.
Good man.
He's asking about everything except for the pork.
Well, I'm not going to ask a personal question like that.
Well, I don't know if they told you about for autumn, but we're blowing you guys up. We got shoulder, the country ribs, and the Canadian loins.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ooh, team dinner?
Team dinner, Park Avenue. Yeah, yeah.
Is there a reason more restaurants don't do a prefix? I always find I like the pricing of it. Like,
Thanks for pronouncing the X. People say prefi. I'm like, it's there's an X.
Who does
not
that?
Every letter in French is silent.
But I think there's good and bad to it. We do it for brunch every weekend. We have a $32 set prefix, but we've done it before, having like different options on the menu for like prefix meals, and it, some people love it, and some people are just curious, to pick their own thing and like to do their own.
All right. Well, it's funny. By the way, we were asked that same question for Heritage Foods. Libby is, we're talking about meal kits, which are essentially prefixes of the mail order world. And it is funny because, A, you have to find choices that are priced the same, you know, so that they even out at the thing. And then you're still kind of limiting the people. It is just more fun to order a la carte than it is prefix, but there's certain savings if you're limited to certain appetizers or whatever. So.
And we're giving meal ideas, so that will be helpful. If you don't know what you want for dinner. So that's a good.
Shopify.com, Heritage Foods. It's a beautiful website. Thanks, Libs.
All right. Speaking of money, we're going to transition a little.
This one's so we have
a friend in the restaurant industry who recently had about $100,000 stolen from within her organization.
By a guy she brought in to help organize, help fix things, help save the business.
And, you know, without naming names, this is not the first time we've actually heard this story. We've heard it from a few friends. So Patrick really wants to know, but we all want to know, what should we do when this happens? What is your responsibility when you hear there are bad people out there? Should you protect your community if you were the one that was hurt? So should you tell people and create maybe like a public list? So we were saying like a sex offenders list for people who steal money and like shouldn't be hired. I don't know. Like, what is our obligation to each other?
They've had problems in all these places. And I've had people who literally have just flat out not paid us. Right. And then I called my lawyer because it got so bad, and they searched and found out that they had done this to 14, 15 other businesses, including Con Ed. And this chef was very popular for a long time here. Now he lives upstate New York and has a restaurant there. And I'm just like, I have to tell my buddy Ben at the Brooklyn Grange and Ann Saxelby at Saxelby Cheesemongers, and just so they don't make that same mistake, because a lot of them also professionally go from place to place. But I've never gotten a call from Ariane or Pat LaFrieda or DeBraga being like, hey, watch out for this guy. And I almost wish I had.
Right. Well, and I think at that point, the onus is on people when they take someone on as a customer to, you know, check the references. Right.
Yeah, credit.
But I mean, does that work? You call the paper company and they're like, yeah, he's good. He pays, you know, but I mean, who, that could be their cousin, or, you know, I don't know how foolproof that is.
It's nothing foolproof, but I mean, you can call other people they've sold to or like that or whatever, and then see how they pay. I mean, that's.
But let's talk about the sex offenders. Well, should there be a database that's kept to say this person has been accused of stealing $100,000?
I'd be real accused. No. I don't. I think you'd run some real libel actions.
You're saying it has to be like
if they're convicted, and so you could bond them. You could do a credit check on them. You could do a lot of things. You could also make them, if you're vending to people, you make them pay cash up front.
A lot of these people work for you, you know, and they're stealing.
Well, if they steal, I know.
And two companies say they've stolen, and reputable business owners are like, he stole cash from my company every single day.
They didn't prosecute?
That's my question. It.
What?
Probably couldn't prove it.
Yeah, they couldn't prove it, yeah.
And, you know, we live in a society where it's like, well, he said, she said. I'm like, no, he said, she said. Just I'm saying this is what happened. And they're like, well, it's cloudy. And then, you know, people accuse us for having faulty accounting. Oh, it was them. They're misorganized. They're so disorganized. I'm like, no, it's none of that. But it's funny. We don't take stands as much as we should. There's always that famous psychology test that they took where everybody of the 30 people in the room were in on the experiment and only one person wasn't. And they asked a very simple question, like, which one of these strings is longer? And everybody is like, the short one is longer. And so eventually the one person was like, I agree with everybody. And you're like, no, dude, you suck.
But that's like a jury. I mean, that's the same thing. It's why people get frustrated when they're sitting on a jury and everyone's in agreement except one. And is the holdout person right or wrong? Or you swayed, you know. But what I was going to say is that I think, and Zine can probably speak to this, you know, when you're hiring a new Sue or a CDC or whoever in your kitchen, many management, you typically poke around. You ask friends. A lot of people in this industry know each other. Checks. You do background checks. You even shoot an old friend a text to be like, is he a good guy? Is he going to screw me? Like, forget about even stealing money, just in their work ethic.
And you know what I think you'll get 90% of the time? No, fine. He had something, but I don't know who was right.
Oh, no, I think people are super honest about that stuff. They'll be like, he puts out a good product on the plate, but he's lazy. Or,
but what you got to be careful of, I know, like, when I was running a business, we only would give good references or no references.
Yeah, or no
references. Because you can be sued if someone loses the job. So you got to be very careful how you do that. I mean, I think that's why I don't think you can have a database. I think it needs to be this informal, maybe stronger than it is, these kind of unions and guilds and trade, you know, people coming together. But
and you mentioned yesterday night that, you know, forgiveness and time, you know, at some point, someone needs to be forgiven for an act. You can't, like, once on the list, you're not on the list forever.
Well, my friend who's an accountant, she said, you know, the advice they give small business owners, you never completely give the reins over. You need to be checking in, whether it's once a month or at least once a month. Like, that's what they tell people. You cannot.
So nothing gets too far afield.
That's why I sit right next to you while you were working on the website. We wanted to make sure there are no curse words being put in there.
Yeah, of course, of course.
So what's next?
All right, we got this one from Sammy Edwards. It's from the Telegraph in the UK. Research shows that farmers should smile at their livestock in order to produce better meat. A study of goats has revealed for the first time that domesticated farm animals can recognize human emotions and respond accordingly. This confirms what farmers and those in the meat production industry already know. The welfare of animals plays a big role in determining the quality of the meat, which is why we invest considerable efforts in ensuring livestock arrive at the slaughterhouse in a calm and happy state. Now, I have to say, is this from Goattober? Are these the goats that they're smiling at?
This is, yes, another self-serving article.
But actually, as I was reading this last night, I was smiling at Cato, Catherine's dog, and I think he knew.
I don't know.
She's
going
to eat me.
I don't know. It sort of just goes back to, I mean, we've, you know, even when we go to our processing facility, Paradise Locker Meats, you have to be the right person even to be in charge of the slaughter floor to bring in the animals. Like, there is something to be said for, you know, a pen was created to make sure that animals are resting, that they're happy, that they're in a good state. So I think, they need to exercise and move around, but smiling can't hurt.
In confinement, you can smile all you want. That animal's still suffering.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
a good farm is a good farm, whether you're showing teeth or not. I think smiling, someone has terrible teeth, could intimidate the animal.
Interestingly, this study was done in the UK, and aren't they known for bad teeth?
Oh my God, the UK, you do not want to smile.
Okay, wait, I want to get this last topic in. We're running low on time for these, but the New York Times reported that thousands of bees swarmed part of Times Square on Tuesday afternoon, sending tourists and passerby scrambling before the bees settle on the cart of a very unhappy hot dog vendor at 43rd Street and Broadway. The massive insects was so dense, it weighed down sections of the stand's umbrella. As it turns out, there are at least a dozen beehives within a block of the cart, and beekeeping in the city is not an uncommon pastime. There is actually an entire organization, the New York City Beekeepers Association, keeping track of beekeepers who are legally required to register their hives. I saw a video of this. It was crazy. All the bees swarming. And
apparently nobody got stung. Do honeybees not sting?
No. It made me think of the X-Files, all those bees that were carriers of the alien virus.
Oh. Yeah. Thanks for the creepy buzzing in our ear.
Yeah, anytime.
Well, they probably thought the umbrella was a big flower.
Yeah. Oh, right? Maybe.
Because they were out of their hive because it was too hot. And they were looking for a cooler space because they're a rooftop. But what I was amazed is there's two NYPD police officers whose whole job is to capture bees when they escape from hives. So there must be enough. I mean, these guys are full-time.
The bee unit.
Yeah. And they took these bees and captured them, gently vacuumed them up and took them out to a hive in Long Island. And they're going to have to feed them through the winter because they can't make honey because it's too late in the season.
Got to give the police credit.
But I mean, it was just...
Got to give them credit this time for showing restraint and not trying to shoot the bees.
No, geez.
They'll take a lot of bullets. It's great. I love that that stuff happens. Yeah. And even if some old person got stung and died, I'd still be fine with it.
Why do you
it's absolutely, that's nature. That's how it is, and we need bees, and we got to be pro-bee, including if they go around.
They were here before us, so.
Yeah. That's true. Them. Although, Patrick's not the biggest fan of local honey.
Well, local honey, the pea-ridden trees that they pollinate around New York City streets is not does not scream gastronomy to me. I don't want my bee to have pollinated the BQE, you know, a little blade of grass that's growing out of the BQE.
Patrick, Emily, remember that kid who got stung by a bee in the backyard of Roberta? We witnessed it.
Yeah, he was screaming, good for him.
He got the little thing right into the back of his neck.
Goes to the hospital. It's probably a good thing. It builds up his immunity. We need. I also love it.
The screaming just went on far too long.
When a polar bear takes out a hunter or some annoying tourist, take him out. Every once in a while, the animals need to win one.
Patrick's like, sacrifice.
Listen, survival of the fittest. Yeah. Let nature do its thing. We can't be so removed and cherish human life to the point that, like, you know, a shark kills a kid in the thing, and then we gotta hunt it down and kill it. We're gonna go kill it. We're gonna an eye for an eye. It's like that's what a shark does.
It's very let it pagan be. Of you, Patrick.
That bears
as the fittest thing. Patrick is talking from. I'm just kidding. All right. Well, that bee story was interesting. But we will go to a quick break, and after we talk all things Park Ave. With Chef Zen. After the Maillard question. So take it away, David.
Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
All right, and welcome back to the Heritage Network Radio, broadcasting live at Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we are the main course OG. So, for the Maillard reaction, the question... Don't really have them, but I was thinking Labor Day, all things Labor Day. And then can we wear white after Labor Day? Or what are you doing on Labor Day?
Chef, I'm going to defer to you on that one. He wears white every day.
All right.
That's true. That's Absolutely. True.
Let's move on. You can't start off the word. This is radio. You can't start off the Meyer question by being like, I don't really have a question. Let's go to the
Patrick
interview.
Wears blue
We're
every
jumping.
Day.
I wear the same outfit. I wore pants because I'm going to French.
Yeah, nice
tonight.
Slacks.
The last four good. Times I've seen him, he's been wearing that shirt.
I know. It's true. It's different. I have eight.
Yeah,
I once made Emily go to buy me shirts at the. It's only Reggie Jackson's only sold at the Hall of Fame store, Yankee Stadium. And I was like, "How much do I owe you?" And she's like, stop. "I bought it on the company card." I'm like, "Oh my god!"
I didn't think
it's
that was
your
the
uniform,
part. Wait,
so.
That was not the part of the story I was going to tell. He gave me a size that is not his size, and he was like, "I'm a medium."
Anne says I dress aspirationally, and then as I go to these
That's
places,
kind.
I'm like, "Can I get a medium, please?" And it's like, "Is this for you?" I'm like, "Yes." She's like, "You're a large. You are not a medium." Anyway, it's funny. So yes, you can wear white whenever you want. That's
especially are you, you know, except if you're at a wedding, you can't upstage the bride.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Well, I need to change over my room is too small for all the clothing. I have to change over and put my summer clothes away on Labor Day. That's
you can leave a little bit of white out.
A little white.
Dean can send you an email when the season's about to change because he puts in a lot of effort every season change.
It's changing this weekend.
I never thought we'd have a fashion consultant on your show.
I know. I know. Thank you. I just don't know them. I don't attract them. Welcome guest Zine Flynn, the executive chef of Park Avenue, and that is a restaurant that's called Park Avenue Summer, Park Avenue Autumn, Park Avenue Winter. So now we are still
forgot about spring.
We're still at Park Avenue Summer for another 48 hours. Zine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You're quite young for an executive chef. What is it like? Do you feel that you receive the same level of respect from your team as you would if you were, say, 50 or 60 or 70 like Tony?
Careful.
Yeah, well, I'm not as young as I used to be. You can't see it from there, but I'm getting a few grays in the beard.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
Okay.
So I've been an executive chef about 5 years now. But no, absolutely. You know, I'm a strong believer in kind of you get what you give out, and, you know, you show respect to everybody and they will, you know, in turn respect you. And so, and just in working methods and how you deal with people, I think that's the biggest thing.
So what's your management style? So someone messes up or, you know, isn't doing their job. I mean, are you a yeller? Are you, three strikes, you're out? I mean, do you have a management style? Because how many employees are you in charge of at that?
We have about 40 or so in the back of the house. Wow. And then another, like, about 50 or 60 in the front of the house. Mm-hmm. I used to be a yeller. You know, I'll you know, be honest, years ago I used to, you know, yell and, you know, make people feel bad. And I've realized over time that that's just not the way to do it. And to create, like, a more of a community within our kitchen and within our restaurant, and, you know, make everybody want to do a good job, because, you know, to support everybody else and to make it easier for everybody else.
Heritage still has the philosophy, the yelling will not stop until the morale improves.
Okay.
Did that transition, you think, just come with sort of age and wisdom and experience? Or, I mean, I know Park Avenue used to be in a smaller location. You were in a townhouse and then you expanded to this much larger restaurant. I don't know, how many years ago now?
Yeah, 4 years, in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
It just came with time, you know, and I think, as the, like, the level of everyone around me rose as well, you know, we've gotten to a point where everything, you know, goes pretty smoothly. And, you know, just over time, I've really realized that I didn't like all the yelling and the anger, and just keeping everyone happy and being nice with everyone and just keeping things positive is just a much better way.
Retention. Also, yeah. It helps with retention.
Absolutely. I've very little turnover. I mean, knock on wood, very little turnover.
And trust is a big thing. Like, I think I also had the same thing that you said, because I didn't know, there was no track record with people. I was nervous. Things, you know, were up and down. You didn't know. Once you have a team and there is retention, all that other stuff comes into place, because you're just like, I trust this person. They do a better job than I would. And you trust them. But at the beginning, you don't know if you trust them yet. So yeah, there's a lot of like, are you screwing things up?
Yeah, definitely. Because we basically had an all new kitchen staff, cooks wise. We have, you know, prep crew and sous chefs and had come from uptown when we moved, but we had an all new cook staff that I think turned over twice in the first basically year, just like turning through people. So
we hear that Autumn, Park Avenue Autumn, it's still summer, but it's about to become autumn.
Yeah,
but
this weekend.
How do you decide when to change over the restaurant, and what does the season change mean for you guys? Because it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, so we have set days every year, except for the spring one. Memorial Day to Labor Day is summer, and it gives us kind of a nice neat little package when everybody's out of town for us to, you know, close the restaurant for 2 days. So we do brunch on Sunday, close for Sunday night, and then we open for Tuesday for dinner.
Why do you need that?
We change all the decor, we change the awnings outside, and then on Monday, the entire staff comes in to try the new menu. Mm. So all the cooks get to see all the new preparations and the platings and how to cook everything. And so we have a full day to just, you know, cook the food and see it.
Wow.
Because the entire menu changes. We have, like, you know, two things that carry over.
And how is Autumn from 1 year to autumn of the other year? I mean, is it pretty similar, or are you always trying to be even different within each autumn?
Yeah, we have classics that we always bring back for each season, but we, you know, it keeps 40-50% of just brand new stuff each season that we come up with between myself and my chef de cuisine and my sous chefs.
Is that good for business? I mean, the Four Seasons was the original restaurant that did that, right?
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, we kind of pushed that to like a macro level. But, it's good for business. I think one of the old advertising slogans was like, if you only go to four restaurants this year, you know, come to Park Avenue, because we're, you know, four different restaurants
right,
in 1 year.
Right.
But, yeah, you see the same people that come back for each season and come back and, you know, they have their favorite seasons. And so, you know, it definitely helps.
I was going to say, what is your favorite season to cook for?
An ingredient.
Well, I really like autumn. I really like autumn and spring. It's the two shortest seasons. Like if we were actually going with the seasons, we'd have, you know, 5 months of winter, months of summer, and then a month of spring and a month of autumn. But I think them being shorter, and then they're just more exciting. You know, summer, it's like hot and everything's like lighter and tomatoes, and winter is just like, you know, a little richer. Spring and autumn give a lot more variability with that.
So what ingredients are we going to see?
A little squash, of course, lots of heritage pork. Yeah, a lot of you know, figs and apples and you know.
So is December for meat? I mean, we don't sell this wholesale, so it's not about us. But I mean, will you do duck and goose and for the winter because those are seasonal animals, or do you try to eat meats in season too? Or is that...
Yeah, we do some like we'll do like rabbit sometimes in the spring, and we do duck, you know, in the autumn, and we have venison coming on the menu for for autumn. So
don't forget about goat in October.
Goat, yeah, absolutely, goat-tober.
Yeah. So I'm very interested about your crew. I grew up on the Upper East Side, so my mom was taking me to Smith and Walensky when I was 3 and 4 years old. It was where I was like going to my first restaurant. So what's it like working with that old crew, like one of the old – I mean, you don't work directly with them, but they're part of your group, right?
Right. No, it's actually really amazing because our corporate office and you know, Smith and Walensky and Maloney and Priscelli, we have these like you know people that have been around doing the same thing in these you know restaurants that have been there for – you know, Smith and Walensky's been there for over 40 years now, and just the amount of knowledge that guys there have for you know, the food industry and for meat and stuff, it's really invaluable for us.
Daniel Kassane.
Danny Kassane, the legend.
Yeah, what's he is such a legend? Tell us about him. He, I mean, he shows up at 5 a.m. every day, huh?
Yeah,
well, I think it's 3:30. Like 3 a.m. Yeah, someone told me 3:30.
Yeah, he wakes up at 11 p.m. no, but yeah, he's there every morning early, and no, he's great. He's helped me out with so many things with different purveyors and with different cuts of meat and just understanding, you know, the business and the purchasing side of things.
Well, very interesting. Well, our last question is, we know you're back from Japan, so yeah. Tell us about Japan. I mean, tell us 3 or 4 things that, you know, our listeners would be interested in, things that struck you about visiting that country for the first time.
I was fortunate enough to go for the agricultural government in Niigata, which is like just a prefecture west of Tokyo. They sponsored some chefs from New York City and from Atlanta to go and try out the products of Niigata, which we got to see soy sauce being made and miso and like Wagyu and, you know, rice fields and, you know, a ton of interesting things. But, you know, just overall, I think just seeing these things and having this connection to this culture, which was amazing, has really opened my eyes to a lot of different things and a lot of different products going forward.
Anything sure. That we might say at Park Avenue, are you like, oh my God, I got to try this soy sauce?
Well, there's a really interesting soy sauce that they make in the area that they age it in snow in these like caverns, because it's like close to like the Nagano region. Mm-hmm. So up in the mountains, they age these big barrels of soy sauce in like snow-covered like huts that they dig into the ground. Mm. And then as we found out, they snow age miso, they snow age Wagyu and things like that as well. But yeah, definitely a lot of really
snow
cool
age.
Products.
Wow.
Snow age. Cool. But yeah, just you know, the organization, the efficiency, how, you know, friendly everybody is. It's really, really a cool place to visit. I got to see Tsukiji Market, which was like a really big moment for me because it's closing down in 2 months and moving outside the city. So the world's largest fish market, and just really cool. A lot of history there.
Wow, fantastic. And the food is just exquisite. When you would go to like a fancy restaurant, are you just like, damn, this fish is
delicious. Everything was so good. Yeah, I had like an uni and chutoro don bowl, like rice bowl, at like 4:30 in the morning at Tsukiji Market. And it was so good. But I mean, I've never eaten raw fish that early. But additionally, like if you think New York gets hot in the summer, like Tokyo is crazy. Yeah, it was when I walked to the market that morning at 4 a.m, it was like 81 degrees with like 75% humidity.
Oh, and my
it was,
God. Yeah.
No rough. Wonder they're snow aging things. Yeah, I think that's the place to be for sure. Yeah, and definitely. Then how many chefs were you traveling with?
So there was 4 of us.
Cool. Yeah.
Very cool. So you recommend Japan for people?
Definitely.
Is Absolutely. It your favorite cuisine? A lot. I used to ask chefs. I did the show for many years, and 70% of the time chefs were like, Japanese cuisine, that's the most interesting cuisine to me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that we're, you know, exposed to less, unless you're, you know, going out to, you know, the prevalence of sushi restaurants in New York is, you know, very high, but very few people go out and like to eat Japanese food. So yeah, and I think it's probably our number 2 most prevalent on our menu after like Italy. You know, with like, you know, pasta and things like that. So.
Very interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming. We recommend all our listeners Park Avenue Summer and then Park Avenue Autumn. Yeah, come check out the new menu and the new decor. It's super cool. But all your restaurants, Smith & Walensky, is definitely a once-a-year place, if not more, you know, definitely. For every New Yorker. Prime rib, exactly. So, Emily, Tony Butler.
Signing off. Happy Thursday, everybody.
Elizabeth Greeley.
That's a wrap, yeah. It's
engineered by David in the studio. Thanks, David. We'll be back, and next is Tech Bites.
If you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88.
Yeah, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.